Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. I'm Hillary Burns, and today we have a very special guest. You're going to be very happy that you met her. Her name is Christine Miles. She is an author, professional keynote speaker, consultant, executive coach, thought leader, entrepreneur, and radio show host. After a lifetime being intrigued with the concept of understanding others, she has become a recognized world expert in the field of listening differently. Now, if you think you know what that means, I beg you to have an open mind and listen as if you don't. Welcome, Christine. Well,
thank you for having me. It's good to be here. Really good to be here.
That's great to see you. Now, do you want to first explain what's behind you? So in case people are wondering.
Sure.
You know what? I can take myself out so they can see the whole thing, right? I'll be right back.
So I can dream it, but I can't paint it. So this is a Promised Land mural. So this is a mural of the listening path that's behind me. And I don't do weather very well, but those are two board games that I've created, one for children and one for the adults that we use in our service business. Eventually we will sell them to businesses and to schools, but for right now they're just when you work with us directly. But that's the listening path.
Awesome. It makes a difference when you can see the whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll be talking more about that. So if you don't know what it means, hold on and we'll get there. So, all right. So I know you're, what do I say? Start at the beginning.
Yes. You're ahead of the game here, Hillary. Yes.
So how did this all begin? I know you're committed to people understanding and really educating people and children on how to listen. And when you read the book, here's her book. The book is, What Is It Costing You Not to Listen?
Mm-hmm.
And there are costs, the power of understanding to connect, influence, solve, and sell. And it's a beautiful book. If you have bad eyes like me, it's big. It's really beautiful. Oh, it came with a cover, which I took off because I didn't want to ruin it at the time when I was reading. But take us back to the beginning. How did this commitment start?
Well, I learned to listen differently, and we can talk about what that means. When I was very young, largely due to my mother, I had other influences, but that was the main reason. She had lost her mother at a very, very early age, only 3 months old. Her mother had rheumatic fever as a child. This was back when there wasn't treatments for these kinds of things. And her heart was weak. The doctors told her not to have children, and she didn't listen to that advice. So my mother was motherless her whole life and suffered from mental illness, including depression and anxiety as a result of that. And, my job was to see the pain that most people didn't see and understand, because my mother was exuberant and lovely and warm and kind and so many things. So they didn't see the pain beneath the surface that it just wasn't obvious. So my job and role in the family was to see and understand that pain. And as I joke and mean, my therapist and I are still working the burden part of that out, because it was a big responsibility. But with that came an incredible gift, which is I learned something that most people aren't taught, this very, very powerful skill. And it's really been the only reason I've succeeded at anything in my life, whether it's from the sports to academic to writing a book. So I'm thinking, why don't we teach this? And there's lots of reasons for that. But my mission is to change that we have a simple way to teach people how to listen and make education of listening available to all ages.
How did you know she had pain?
She talked about it.
You
We
did.
had a, she did, and I learned to watch what it didn't match. It just didn't match up. And interestingly, part I remember being in like doctors' waiting rooms, and my mother was very open and, gregarious, and so she would have conversations, and she was also a very good listener. So I remember being in places and her having these deeper conversations, and when people would hear her story, when she would share some of this, they'd rush in and try to remind her of like her life's so good now. Like, be happy about it. Like, look at where you are now, not what you lost. This whole like, let me cheer you up thing, which we all fall into sometimes. We become cheerleaders instead of listeners. And what I saw, and I think this, what I know is this started much more than the waiting rooms I was in. This was from the time she was very, very little, that she didn't feel understood. The loss wasn't really talked about a lot. So that's part of why she tried to talk about it. But people had a hard time wanting to go there. And I saw the costs of those well-intended interactions. I call that death by a thousand cuts. Like they just inflicted a small wound every time her pain was denied. And denied. And again, this is a universal human experience. We've all had something happen, and we get talked out of it or tried to be talked out of it. So I saw that, and that's the kind of thing. I saw the interactions, not just the pain that she had. I was aware of her pain below the surface for lots of reasons, but that's the real pain that I saw is how people didn't get her. Yeah.
And how did that make you feel?
Ha,
Yeah.
great question. I felt for my mother. I had such empathy for her even as a little girl because I couldn't imagine not having a mother in the way my young brain could relate to it. So it was sad for me. And I also saw this wonderful, kind mother herself. She wasn't perfect, I mean, but so she really did try to give me what she didn't get. And ironically, she replicated the pattern because often I didn't feel as seen because her pain kind of was part of that. So history has a way of repeating itself. So it certainly had some downsides. But like I said, the bigger win was that I got this really kind of remarkable gift.
I mean, did you feel her pain? Like, did you feel it too, or you were more an observer? Like, I'm just.
No, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't take it on. If
Okay.
that's what you mean, no, I
Yeah.
didn't feel burdened like that. It was more just knowing that I had a mom who had that kind of profound pain that she had to live with. But she was also very good at letting me be my own person. She didn't try to engulf me in a way that I couldn't, be. She wanted me to thrive, and she wanted me to be confident, and she wanted me to be as much as I could be, even though she needed me in ways that weren't always age appropriate. Yeah, so it was a little bit of both. So, look, we don't go into the field of psychology unless we're trying to fix our own crazy. So I am the living proof of that. So, and I do, giving, listening is a gift. So there's no question her wounds and whatever wounds I have, part of my healing is to give this gift of understanding. It really does make me heal, the stuff that she felt and I felt. And that's a part of the mission is like her loss and her sadness really is the reason that I want to do this. And I think it makes even more meaning out of what she suffered from, for sure.
And is it that people didn't allow her to have the pain or her pain or all of it? Do you know what I mean? Like, what's the part of the understanding?
I think it's hard to understand something you haven't experienced. And thankfully, most of us haven't been motherless. Certainly, many people have, but not most of us. And it's just really hard to understand pain you can't see. I think that's really, it wasn't ill will. We're very well intentioned, but because we're taught, and pardon me, we're told to listen and not taught. One of the things we don't know how to always do is be emotionally with somebody and present with them when they're experiencing something rather than talking them out of it. So that's really, again, we're failing, but it's really not our fault. So, I think it was really more about that most people have three or five emotions they can name. It's hard to go beyond that because we do not socialize people to have a stronger emotional skill set around, and that's part of listening, the emotions of yourself and emotions of others, which is why this is an emotional intelligence skill, what I call the foundation of the house for emotional intelligence. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So, all right. So you had that as a child. You knew
I did.
You knew you wanted to be in psychology, I think, when you were age five or something. Or
eight. First time somebody asked me, I remember I was eight. It was one of my dad's friends. And I just said, I want to be a psychologist. Yeah. I sort of knew what that meant because my mother went to a psychologist. My dad had talked to me about, he had been to a psychologist. So it wasn't like it was a bad, it was a great thing. They helped people. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And you were an athlete, obviously a very high level field hockey player, right?
Ultimately, I did pretty well despite my very average abilities. Yes, that's true. I was an average athlete.
And why do you think that is, that you did so well? Or are you just being humble?
Oh, I wish I were being humble. People are funny. I know I've achieved some pretty extraordinary things. I know that. And I know that it's not because I was born into it. Like, that's just not what I was capable of. You know, the listening helps. I had amazing coaches. I was very, very fortunate. Both my high school and college coaches were U.S. field hockey players. So I had good role models. And I had an amazing coach in high school that was just – but I really did know how to read the game. And I knew how to understand my teammates. And I also learned how to motivate myself because I listened well to myself. So I knew what I wanted and I knew how to get it. I was coachable. Mm-hmm. That was probably, you know, I got the, Christine was a pleasure to have in class more than I got. She's the best student. So I knew how to navigate those things. And that was helpful. That's, you know, a lot of people in business want people to be more strategic. And that's the thing. Can you see more strategically? Some of that is inherent in how we're wired and personality. Listening makes us more strategic. When you widen your vision, then you can see more. You can be more strategic. Like chess, if you can do six moves to get to versus three, you're going to win the chess game. So that's about how you lens out a little bit more. And that's what listening does. So even athletically, that really helped me. Yeah.
Yeah, I like the story about how you didn't like running, but you didn't mind what chasing the ball or whatever you were doing with the ball. It distracted you from what you were doing so that you got to be a better runner. But not, I mean, I think that example for people, again, if you buy this book, if you're a parent, there's so many good examples for how to help your children. I don't know if it's tricking them, but you're tricking them into success. So it's not a bad thing, right?
It's not a bad thing. My coaches did that. I'm not a good runner. I'm 5'9". People would have called me lanky in college. And just because I have very long limbs. And so I didn't like running just to go out for a run. That was painful for me. But if you chase that ball, if you threw that ball, I chase it all day. So I use that as an example, not only for how to do things that are painful that you don't necessarily want to do, make it fun. My coaches were really good at that, but also that emotional intelligence is something that in the 21st century in particular, we need to build because AI, digitization of everything, how we're differentiating, these human skills become more and more important in the world that we're living in, and they're diminishing because of technology. So this is something to build and make more robust to be successful. 90% of star performance is emotional intelligence. It comes from emotional intelligence. So to me, learning to be more emotionally intelligent can be a very arduous process. A lot of self-reflection, a lot of things you have to do. Those are important, but I just want to also make it simpler. And when you learn to listen, you're throwing the ball and your emotional intelligence is just going to come up. Because when you learn this skill, it helps that elevate without you having to work so hard at it, which is the part of why I use that example in the book.
So I'm just thinking of this. It's not in the book, but you know, like a Roger Federer who there was a time when he didn't lose. Even if he was losing, he would come back.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that was this in some way? Like, how did he do?
Yes.
Can you explain it?
Well, so and I've pl started to play tennis in my later life here, and I gotta say, as a team athlete, my entire career, tennis singles is brutal. You are alone out there. So they talk about something about tennis IQ, and that is a form of EQ, because what they mean is, how are you sizing up your opponent? Where are they hitting the ball? Are you going to their weaknesses? You got to pay attention to what they're doing, and you have to be able to. There's a whole process around tennis, like flush the last shot, because in professional tennis, it's 41, it's 51-49 when you most of the time you're not supposed to win every point. It's just not possible. So you have to be resilient and have that perseverance. And all these are emotional skills. It's not about how well you hit the tennis ball. It's about how do you handle your nerve? How do you size up your opponent? And this is metaphoric for life, in my opinion.
It take because their skill level is probably very similar. So what is it? I always wondered, like, what is it that has him win? You know, and the other guys are so close, and then they don't. You know, it's very interesting.
I play tennis with a woman who she doesn't do anything super, super special in the tennis court. Like she's, we're weekend, we're weekend athletes at this point. But I can be down. I mean, I can be winning way up, and she just has a way of just fighting her way back. And it doesn't look like she's trying that hard in a way, but she's just tenacious. And even if I'm, hitting the ball harder or doing, she just manages to kind of hit the metronome and come back. And it's annoying. But it's a talent. It's because you have to have that attitude and that mentality to be able to persevere through that and hold it together. So yeah, it's there's something to that. And I've been able to succeed a lot of ways in my life because of that as well.
I have a funny story. I was because I was a really good choke artist. Like I could be winning and then lose. And
What's
so
a
one
choke
day,
artist? Sorry, I don't know what that is.
like I would choke, like I would be ahead, I would be winning, and then
Oh,
like,
I see. I
what the
see.
hell
Okay.
happened? So one day I was playing a tournament, and my friend was next to me, and I was winning. I mean, it was like 6-0, whatever. I was very close to winning, and all of a sudden I'm losing. And I said to my friend next to me, "What happened?" And she goes, "You stopped running." So when I thought I had it, I stopped doing what I had done to get there. And I was like, thank God she was there and noticed. Like, because I had no con I didn't had no idea that I'd stopped running. So that and then I won. But I would never have known, you know, I would start thinking about winning instead of how to play each spot,
That's
which is,
right.
and then it happened so many times. So anyway, but
I'm with, well,
I'm
they talk about, they talk, if you listen to commentators on the tennis court, they talk about problem solving. You need to problem solve out there. So this is why I love sports, and I talk about sports in the book as an analogy. It can be music, it could be dance, it can be whatever, but because it is metaphoric to how we have to get through life. Sports taught me a lot about, how to be persevering and how to do things. And but problem solving is a big part of, that's an emotional intelligence skill that we need to do every day, that we want to get better at.
But like, how would I have known? I don't know that I could have solved the problem because I didn't know what it was. I knew I was losing, but I didn't know what it was. So I don't know. I give people a lot of credit if they're out there by
Well, being able to
themselves.
take, oh, well, totally, and but be able to take that feedback is also an emotional intelligence skill, rather than what are you talking about? You don't know what, so that's part of how do you listen to others. And we don't always agree with what people say. We don't always like it, but if we're willing to at least listen to it and try to understand it, then we can make our own decision. But yeah, that's an important part of it as well.
All right. So next topic, if you don't mind.
No.
I know, you know, you graduated and you went into the field and all that stuff, and people can read about that in the book. It's very interesting. Great stories, great lessons. When you had your accident, do you want to take us back to the beginning?
Sure. Yeah, well, the accident was a car accident, just to clarify. So I was 28 years old and I had already been working for 6 years, believe it or not, as a family therapist, which is not a statement that most people can make. It's part of why I got the gig was because I listened well, and some other accomplishments. But so I had started this new job where I was working at an employee assistance program for the first time, taking all my psychology into business, which was really thrilling to me. My dad was a businessman and entrepreneur, and I always wanted to do that. So I was a month into this job, and I'm on my way to work at 8:30 in the morning, and I'm in a school zone. So just to paint the picture, it wasn't a high speed accident. But I turned on a road that I still live fairly close to, and a gentleman was passed out at the wheel coming. He was passed out the wheel on the accelerator and started coming towards me. So I started honking kind of relentlessly to wake him up, and unfortunately he didn't wake up and hit me pretty dead on. It was the calamity of things. It was all the right circumstances to create the kind of problem I now understand. But neither car gave. It was back when that wasn't the design of the car. It was steel on steel, and my body took the brunt of it. So I often say it's kind of ironic that I was hit by somebody who was passed out at the wheel, because we're kind of passed out at the wheel of how we listen. And it's interesting from that standpoint, the irony of it, and the irony of how history repeated itself, because I had 3 years of chronic pain that I worked really hard to figure out, and I was still playing competitive hockey. I couldn't shoot a basketball anymore, riding a bike, anything like too hard on really leaning over more. The way I played hockey, I was more upright, was very difficult, and I just could imagine giving up the sport, even though it was painful. And then at 31, I went from chronic to acute. So I had a couple surgeries already, trying to figure it out. I had been to all the best doctors I thought, and I went to a physical therapy appointment, and I went in the bathroom. I came out, I couldn't pull up my shorts. The tears just the pain went from 3 to 10 instantly. So my life changed very, very quickly. And but I looked fine. I looked fine. Just like my mother. My mother's pain was psychological, mine was physical, both were invisible to others. And it was really hard because people wanted to understand, they struggled to understand what they couldn't see. But when I had those moments where people really got it and leaned into it with me, I felt the power on a whole different level from being in that kind of lonely experience. And that was a turning point from a career standpoint too, because I had to figure out how to work with this injury, and became an entrepreneur at that age because I still wanted to work. And then that's really when I started to get more and more into this business of communication, and particularly listening.
So, all right, I just have to ask. If you hadn't kept playing field hockey, and I know you can't go back, but this question is haunting me. Would it have gotten as bad? Do you think that it would have? Well, was it because you were playing that made it worse?
No. What I learned it was that I had a compression fracture on my low vertebrae, so my head was tilted forward, and there was nothing I could do about it. It was just a matter of time before it was going to break. So my there's a joint in the neck that's called a facet joint, and that collapsed basically after because your head's heavy. So because my and it took I went to New Orleans and I saw a world-renowned. The world-renowned interventional radiologist, who was the one who finally diagnosed me. It's a good, it's a fair question. But no, it maybe would have taken a little longer. Maybe, I don't know. But it wasn't changed. It wouldn't have changed it.
28, I know I'm being the lawyer now, but
That's
excuse
okay.
me. So from 28 to 31, you were playing and blah, blah, blah. 31, it breaks. And then you were in pain for 10 years. When did you find that guy in New
Oh,
Orleans?
so I found the guy in New Orleans. I was 32, and we. So, I had a pretty complicated situation because cervical. By the way, they would not do this anymore.
Where is cervical? Where?
Cervical is your neck.
Your neck.
It's a much trickier place to have a. It's a more difficult place to have a injury, especially since mine went down to my thoracic spine. So C8 is the bottom of your cervical spine. What happened was they don't generally go below that. It's very tricky to get to. And even though I saw this world-renowned physician, we didn't go below the segment because it's dangerous. And it turns out that was also injured. Like I had some problems there. So it got missed. So I had three major spinal surgeries in the course of 5 years. And again, there's so many more options now. They don't have to fuse. I used to say, I hope they're not doing this in 15, 20 years because it's not a great solution.
Wow.
But so, it was just, and I had a doctor say to me, the medical community really failed you despite your persistence. And they did, and they didn't, they did the best they could. And I, but yeah, it was complicated. So I was in acute pain. I really was fighting for my
Oh.
life to get my life back from 31 to 41. And then it got better. And, it's managed, not cured like many of us. Somebody has diabetes or other issues or arthritis. But I have to work really, really hard to keep my body healthy and my spine healthy. Yeah.
And there was one of the guys that you did the video for, and you said that in 3 months he really helped you. When was that, or was that long?
Yeah. So that was like 2016. I saw. So I used to say, you tell me to go stand in a corner on my head, and I'll try it to make. You name it, I'll try it. I'll throw anything at this thing. And so I had seen chiropractors who had been semi-helpful, but nothing was game-changing. But I met an upper cervical chiropractor. I went to do a talk for his practice, like for his community. And I thought I didn't know what upper cervical meant. Turned out at the time there's only 200 in the country. They're specialized, and there's a longer story there. And he said, Christine, you should really see me. And I'm like, I've been to chiropractors, Bill, blah, 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 and he goes, trust me. And he tells me the story of how upper cervical, how it was created. And I go, I'll go stand in my, I'll give it a shot. So honestly, they teach the spine to self-adjust from C1 only. And within 2 weeks, I was doing things I hadn't been able to do. And I had a headache, a massive headache for 20 years, and he got rid of that headache. It's
Wow.
crazy. Yeah. So many of us could benefit from that. I'm not here to do a commercial for that, but if you have a lower back problem, an upper back problem, you have headaches or anything, look up upper cervical chiropractic. It's the most benign, game-changing treatment you can consider for your overall health, sinus problems, skin problems,
Wow.
anxiety problems. Yeah, because our brain feeds our spine through the synovial fluid, and this helps get that moving in the right way. Yeah.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, that's good for people to know.
Sure.
I hadn't
Yeah.
heard of that. Yeah. Okay. All right. So throughout that time, and obviously you've taken us up to 2016, what year was the accident?
93. 97 is when I started the surgery train, and 93 was the accident. Yeah.
So that's 20 years before you had a little relief, right? Almost 19.
I had relief from ultimately from the last spinal surgery, and then I had a lot of work to do to get a lot of scar tissue, a lot of problems, countless procedures. But that I was doing better, but that really took me to a whole another stratosphere. Yeah, so I'm very grateful for that. And him.
And
Yeah.
why was the guy passed out? Was he just tired, or had he had a heart attack, or did you ever find
They
out?
didn't, it was 8:30 in the morning in the 90s, so they didn't drug and alcohol test him, which they probably should have. Yeah, so I don't know. He didn't wake up until after impact, so something was wrong. And I only ever saw him at a deposition later. I wasn't allowed to talk to him, so I don't believe he had a medical issue. But people are like, aren't you upset, aren't you mad? And I'm like, sure, but what does that serve me? So yeah. So
Oof, okay. All right. So you were in all these therapies, the psychology and all these things, and then what had you branch out to your own thing? When was that?
I started working as a consultant for the company that I worked for full time after my accident. And then in 2007, I started my first coaching practice. I went out on my own. And here's what I realized. This was So I started working for companies and always around the people. I'm not going to tell you how to run your business, but I can help you get the people to run your business better. And I was solving the same problem over and over and over and over again. And it was so interesting. So I did, for 4 years I was mired into solving the same thing. And it really boiled down to not what was said, but to what people didn't understand. That's where the miscommunication was. So board meetings, project meetings in general, between colleagues, between the customers, the salespeople, it was all about what wasn't understood. And I was finding ways to get to that faster, but I knew then that I needed there was a better way. Like there had to be a systemic solution to this problem. I just didn't have the answer yet. But
And
that was when it occurred to me. Yeah.
can you give an example? Like,
Of what was going on?
yeah,
Yeah, I
how
mean,
they didn't understand, like, what was happening.
so I had a guy. He was the controller for a company, and he was very well intended, very good at finance, and he had a team of females, all women. And I got called, and I was consulting with this company, and I knew him, so this wasn't cold. But I, can you talk to so and so because we had an issue with them this morning. He was scaring people like in the office, like going around the cubicle, boo, like you can't make this stuff up, right? So I was like, okay. So I sat down. Now, what would most people do? They're like, this guy's an asshole, right? That's what the assumption was. I knew better, but I was confused. So when I sat down with him, I said,
Boom.
take me back to the beginning. And he said, I'm having trouble connecting with the people in my department, the women that are working for me. They're just not, we're not doing well together. And they were struggling, and I did know that. And so tell me more. We went through the whole thing. And what I learned was through gathering his story is that he was the last time he had managed people, he worked with all men and they were in their 30s. And they used to screw around with each other and joke around and, try to scare each other and do sophomoric things, which, okay. And so he was attempting to connect with them by just joking around with this was a joking around situation, but that's not how it was interpreted. So we had a longer conversation, but that's an example of a misunderstanding. Like he's making it now. I'm not saying that's not a pretty big mistake, but it was bad judgment more than it was ill intent. So it was about, okay, let's find another way to understand what's going on rather than just trying to solve the problem by joking around. And we did manage to figure that out, but that was an extreme example of what he didn't understand about how to connect and how to so yeah. And I mean, I could give you there's thousands. It's just constant.
All right, so you kept, let's stop here for the commercial break. You kept running into the same problem, and that's where we'll start when we come back.
Okay,
All right,
you
great.
got it.
Great. Awesome.
Has social emotional learning become just one more thing on your teacher's plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. KIKORI.
Do you ever feel like you can't say what you really want to say? Or that you're stuck or in a holding pattern in your relationships, career, personal life, or finances? Are there things you want in life that you've given up on? Are you resigned that this is as good as it's going to get? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then Hillary Burns, host of the Getting Real with Hillary Show, has the solution you need. Hillary is a published author of three books and has a program called The Getting Real Process. This process frees you from what is holding you back, allowing you to create a life you love. Don't believe it? It is hard to believe that it could work, isn't it? The proof is that hundreds of Hillary's clients have used the Getting Real process and are now free to create whatever they want in relationships, career, finances, enjoying life, or just loving themselves more. So go to realtalkwithhillary.com and order Hillary's book, Real Talk, and set up a conversation.
Okay, and as always, thank you to our sponsor, KikoriApp.com. So Kikori definitely ties in to what Christine is talking about in terms of social emotional learning and connection for the children. They come out of their you know, automatic brain. If they're anxious or whatever, they come out and they get back like into their heart, and then they can learn. So if you want to bring that into your schools, go to KikoriApp.com and schedule a consultation. Parents are loving it now because their children who weren't talking to them before, especially after COVID, are now communicating. They have activities that really do connect you. And so not only do the schools, the teachers, the students love it, but parents also. So that's an avenue for you. And then my books, let's see, which one should I start with? Well, I think I'm going to start with Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. This one is techniques for going from what I call the dark side of life to the fun side. And there was something that Christine said that reminded me of this one, and I can't remember what it is, but I think it's like accepting yourself. When I accepted my negativity and I decided to use that for good, I came up with these techniques that I played with, and I really had a good time writing this. And the subtitle is How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun. So that one is that, Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. This one, I'm going backwards in time, Real Talk, the subtitle, How to Say the Things You've Never Said so You Can Have the Things You've Always Wanted. And this was hard for me. After I wrote my first book, someone said, why didn't you speak up? And I was like, oh, I didn't know I wasn't. So I have the Getting Real process, and that helped me. If that's you, get in touch with me and we'll work together to get you free. And then my very first book that took me 7 years to write, The Second Piece of French Toast, 7 years to rewrite. If marriage was my dream, why was I numbing myself? Well, you'll find out why in the book, and it does have a happy ending, but if you find yourself stuck, you might relate to the book, and it might inspire you also to take actions and start creating a life that you love instead of one you feel you're stuck with, which is what I did. So anyway, welcome back to the stage, Christine Miles.
Hello.
All right. So where were we? We were that you kept seeing the same problem. So that's
yeah.
Why you decided to branch out on your own. Which I'm sure
yeah, well,
helps, right?
Yeah, well, it so yeah, it helped me realize that we have a bigger problem to solve. That, you know, the things I was taking for granted, I knew I was successful because of listening. I also knew people were failing, starting working with families because they weren't. But I didn't really get that there was such a big communication problem and gap. And so that's when it really started to hit me. By 2011, I was really like, and I had started working with Mike Bosworth, who wrote Solution Selling in the 70s with Xerox, and he had a new book out, and it was really about the power of storytelling. And when I tapped into storytelling is when I figured out the systemic fix, basically. And I have a systems background, meaning that I was a trained systems therapist. So when I was going to people's houses, it was to treat the family of kids who had been in psychiatric trouble because of acting out or, you know, having difficulties. And rather than going in and just looking at the child, we looked at the whole family system to help them reintegrate and really organize differently around the child so that the child didn't have those needs to act out as much. So similarly, that's what I started to think about when I tried to solve the communication problem of misunderstanding, is how do we treat the system. The symptom we've been treating is let's speak better. That's what's always been taught. Mm-hmm. Speaking, speaking, speaking. Yeah. And speaking is important, but we're missing 55% of communication by not teaching people how to listen.
And was that easily embraced by your clients?
No.
I know in the book, there's like a bunch of chapters telling people, you know, everyone knows they need to listen, but they don't know how. And everyone thinks they're a good listener, right? I think I'm a good listener. You know, everyone thinks they're good, but they're missing a lot. So
How can you solve a problem you don't know you have? Like, right. That's like, right. I was like, if you had the flu since you were a little kid, you wouldn't know what it feels like to have the, like, you wouldn't get that that's right. The flu. It's just there. So 96% of people believe they're good listeners. That's not even mathematically possible as far as I'm concerned, right. But I don't know math that well. But it's part of it. And there, I talk about this as well, that
what is the percent again? Wait, what is the percent?
96% of people rate themselves, believe they're good listeners. And here's why, because we don't have a good, we don't know what we're evaluating.
Right. We don't know what we're comparing it to.
It's like our driving. This is what Harvard Business Review found. We rate our listening skills like our driving. We think we're better than we are. So let's, you and I are, well, we know this.
I don't rate my driving high. So
that's good. It's good self-awareness.
Depends if I'm distracted or not. Yeah.
So, but it's also, is being a slower driver better or a faster driver better? So some people say, I'm a slower driver, I'm more careful, I'm a better driver than so-and-so who drives faster. It's all in the eye of the beholder, because I feel safer going slower. They feel safer going fast, whatever the reasoning is. Same is true with listening.
We call it mishigas, right?
Is that what that's called?
Craziness.
I like it.
It's our craziness, mishigas.
It's crazy. And that's why. So it's a large part of why. And we also think good intentions are enough. So if I intend to listen, then I'm therefore going to do it well. That could not be further from the truth either, because our brains, our subconscious brain is the greatest enemy of listening. You can white knuckle it, but you don't have control over the superpower like without training.
So a big part of your job is letting them know what the problem is first.
That's why I titled the book what I titled it. How can you solve a problem? Yeah. Yeah, instead of the solution.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cost. And the costs are high.
Yeah.
The costs are high. In business, they're inordinately high. They're just invisible. They just feel invisible because we can't tangibly go, oh, that's what cost it. But
So once people get the cost and they get that they're not doing it through you have wonderful videos, and I think the one with the guy singing, Amazing, great. I think they're all good.
Thank you.
Anyway, then you set out to teach them how.
Yeah. Right?
And does that get welcomed pretty?
It does now. I think, I wrote the book, so I've been beating this drum for quite a while. And in 2011, storytelling came really hot on the landscape. You may remember this as well. That, look, it's been around forever, and it's even been around as a business tool forever. But because neuroscience said we buy limbically, we know the brain lights up emotionally when we buy, marketers, salespeople went, storytelling's the answer. Mm. We get people in their limbic brain, that's how they're going to buy. And I was like, amen. Yes. And you can't tell the right story unless you know the story you need to tell.
Right.
And the only way you know the story you need to tell is by understanding your audience and what they need. And so that's a gathering skill. Even to build a story, you have to gather it first. Your journalists, what do? They get the story to tell the story. Mm. So we were missing the first part of this and rushing to storytelling. And I saw two things happen. One, they were missing it. And two, storytelling is really hard, just like listening has been really hard. And it wasn't sticking. Because if you don't know how to get it, it's really hard to know how to tell it. So I believed we needed to do this first. And I would always sneak it in and always insist when I went out to do, and we went out to do work, that we would do that first. Now I can lead with listening and people get it. Because COVID changed the world.
So when you were working with Mike, That's what you were doing was the storytelling, and that's when you started leading with the other.
I started to talk with Mike, and understandably, like about this, he had a little bit about the listening, that we needed more of that, and it didn't make sense for him to dig into that at that point. So he was he was such a good mentor and so gracious with me, and he said, "Christine, go off and do your thing, like go do it." But it's been an evolution, and I only wrote about the path in 2021 because what I realized is that listening is really like fog or oxygen. You see it, but you don't see it. You know it's there. You know it breathes life into everything, but it's hard to grab it. And so I had to help make it more tangible for people.
So, okay. So I have a question. So in the book, she goes through the six questions or four, whatever, the questions. And, you know, so I was thinking about when you first told me about your accident and I wanted to know, like, if you were okay now, right?
Yeah.
That's like, that was like my curiosity that I wanted to quell.
Yeah.
Now I didn't know the questions. I didn't know anything back then.
Sure.
But as I'm reading the book, I'm like, oh, I should have said, you know, go back to the beginning, or I should have said something else. But then it's like, okay, no, we were just having a conversation. Like, when is this appropriate? Is it just in business? Is it just, you know, when there's a problem? Like, or, you know, because now I'm like, oh my God, I got to say the right thing. And I'm getting all crazy trying to get it right. And now I'm I can't just talk to someone. Blah. You know, like, when is this appropriate and when is it not? Or is it always? And I just haven't learned it enough to relax. And
in terms of to ask the questions or just to make sure
to
I understand your questions.
To story gather, you know.
Yeah, always.
Always, okay.
So a couple things, just to orient your audience. So.
Please. I like to skip around, yeah.
Well,
I like to say, hey, you got to read the book to figure it out. No, I'm just kidding.
You're going to make my point, and I mean this with all due respect. We are not great storytellers in general, in conversations, right? We're not taught the skills. And you're excited, and I appreciate this, about all the things that you read, but you're in the middle of the movie. Like, you dropped your audience right in the middle of the movie. These questions, they're going, what questions? I go, let me help you.
Okay, thanks.
But that's what happens in life. That's what happens in life. So that's what's so beautiful about what you just did. The questions are the most powerful questions you need to gather the story. So the story of the listening path is you wouldn't go hiking in the woods. Maybe you wouldn't go anyway, some of us, but I like the woods, unprepared. If I said, go camping for a couple of days, you take supplies. We go into the conversational woods all the time unprepared. And it's very easy to get lost. It's very easy to get confused. It's very easy to get hurt if you're not doing it well. So the listening path is the path to understanding. We give you the tools to understand. And one of those tools is a compass so that you can guide the speaker as the listener to tell their story in a way you can understand. So you use take me back to the beginning when you asked me earlier about the accident instead of are you okay now, which is what you wanted to ask, right?
Well, I had asked that before and I knew the answer. So the first time I did say that because I didn't have the tools.
Yeah. You know. So I appreciate that you care if I'm okay. That's a loaded question in and of itself because the answer is yes and no.
Right.
Yes, I'm okay relative to what I was. And no, I'm never it's my new normal. Mm-hmm. So it's our need to want to make sure I'm okay. But it's really more what matters is what I went through, not what I ended up with, if you know what I mean. So that's why. So helpful. And you miss a lot of the story, but much like my mother, that's what people wanted to tell her, that she was okay now versus, oh, this is what you went through. And that's why you have pain now. They wanted to make people okay. They wanted to make her okay rather. Yeah.
Right. So if I say, take me back to the beginning, you did. Mm-hmm. And then I could have said, tell me more or how do you feel? How do you feel?
And you did.
Yeah.
Tell me how does it make you feel or how sounds like you felt. So they're on the compass. And these are the questions that therapists and journalists use because they're story gatherers. and professional listeners, podcast hosts. there's four facts and two feeling questions. So you're guaranteed to get the story with just those questions. So listening practices tell you be curious, ask good questions, and that's how you get the story. The problem is that questions interfere with listening. Because we shape the story, we guide, we misdirect it. And they will say ask open-ended questions, but it's really hard for people on the fly to figure out how to ask an open-ended question. So here are the only six you need, and you'll get them.
Yeah.
I've had friends go like, how did you find that out? I go, I just said, how are you? Tell me more. And people will tell you. Yeah. The time not to do it is if you're on an airplane and you want to be by yourself. Don't use this then. That's not when to use it. Because once you start listening, it's a gift that people, it's very rare that people will want to share more.
Mm. So the questions, did you get them from the journalists or did you come up with them yourself? Did you figure them out and then realize they were the same? Or did someone give you the questions?
This Mike talked about a few of these questions.
Okay.
What changed was only using these questions rather than just making them as suggestive questions.
Right.
We did an experiment with what happens if you only use these questions rather than letting it up to, and that's really what changed the game, is just use these and watch what happens. Yeah.
Was that the first time you had done that? And again, I'm middle of the movie, in the book. When you were at University of Pennsylvania, right? And you were doing, was that the first time
Drexel.
That you saw the impact of just?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember how I decided to do that. Because I started training when I was 28. I started going out to like hospital. I'd write like, we got to go do something for the nurses and I'd write like a training. So I don't know why I decided to do it that way. That I can't jar in my mind, but I remember that moment being incredibly profound. Yeah.
And then it was
about an experiment.
You.
Wow. Yeah. So we've had salespeople say, I get more from just using those six questions than I would in five meetings. I've had parents say, I had a game-changing conversation. A meaningful conversation with my child that I've never had before, just from these six. I mean, I could tell you story after story after story of what a profound change. I had somebody call me who read the book. He's a realtor. He just said, I appreciate your book. I wanted to meet you. You know, he used my contact information. We had a discussion. He said he was in recovery for 8 years. And he has a sponsor who's very close to, but he said, I decided we were going to lunch and I decided I'm only going to use these compass questions when I have a conversation. And that's all I did. And he said, at the end of the lunch, this guy said, his sponsor, you know, I've only ever told two people that in my life and you're the second person.
Wow.
And he said, I know this man very, very well. Mm. And he said, I needed to hear that, but more importantly, he needed to tell me that.
Yeah.
So it's very powerful stuff.
Now, we only have a few minutes left.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I mean, all right, I'll ask you this after. I'm not going to not spend the time now since I'm curious. So what would you want to leave people with? I know they can find you want to give them your website. What's your vision for the world?
They can find... 15 minutes later, Miles is still talking. I always say it's funny that I'm a speaker about listening. Yeah. That's funny, right? Ironically. But you got to know your audience. So they can find us at thelisteningpath.com. And the compass, right, by the way, right there, there's something they can download and it'll give it to them right off the bat. They can also find me at Christine Miles Listens. That's my speaker's website if somebody wants me to speak. Okay. My mission is to change the world by providing listening education to children as well and to continue doing it as an adult. So we have a program for elementary schools. It's plug and play. Teachers implement it. It's called the Listening Path for Elementary Schools 1-6. In the fall, we'll have the high school program ready. We already have a high school in Ireland that taught 250 high school boys. So my mission is to bring listening education to close that gap because there's nothing in schools formally on listening.
Okay, so let's say you do that. How is the world in 5 years? What's possible?
Well, we have young people who are future ready for work, for starters. Mm. They're going to be better innovators, problem solvers. They're going to be better learners. You learn to learn when you're little, by the way. That's a learning skill. Listening helps you learn. And hopefully we can have healthy discourse in our conversations to solve big problems, because right now we're very polarized, and the generations that are raised on digital devices are suffering, their muscles atrophying even more. So we need to reconnect and build that muscle so that we can have meaningful conversations and solve tough problems. So this is a big thing.
Mm. Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, for your courage, for your fortitude, for your persistence, even through the pain, and just for making this available. I mean, I recommend this book literally to everybody. There's no one who should not read this, if that's a backwards negative, but really, really, it's just really huge and profound. So thank you, Christine. I really mean it from the bottom of my heart for the work that you're doing.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started Getting Real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.